flame ionization detection. So we've got a lot of data for these trees. And in, for this, what I'm going to show you is really just focusing on our most northern site and our southern site in both climatic suitability zones, so Quesnel and Princeton. And the distance between those is about 500 kilometers or 300 meters. So this is the widest geographic range we sampled in British Columbia. And my graphs all look very similar, so I'll just take a moment to explain what you're looking at. On the x-axis, you have the southern site and the northern site with both climatic suitability. So H is the high climatic suitability class, and L is the low in the southern site, and the high and the low climatic suitability class in the north. And then the Y is the dependent variable. In this case, what you have here is you have the mean total terpenes that we tested, so all 26 of them just together, to see if there were differences in just the amount of terpenes that we got. And what you can see is that there were. In the north, there tended to be more just total terpenes present in the constitutive resin. Most of the individual terpenes that we tested followed a similar pattern, where there tended to be more in the north than we found in the south. So this is just alpha pinene and same location concentration. What was interesting is when we counted up the mountain pine beetle attacks on the tree, we had a much higher number of attacks on the trees in the north than the trees in the south. This wasn't entirely what we were expecting, but that's what we found. And so what we drew from this part of the experiment was that there just seems to be a higher total terpene content in the north, particularly in the low climatic suitability class site, which is the site that's least likely to have been exposed to mountain pine beetle before. In addition, we just had higher mountain pine beetle attack density in the northern sites. So this has led us to a couple possible hypotheses to explain this. And it could indicate that their historical beetle pressure on the pines has influenced the tree's ability to defend itself with terpenes. Whether that's that the trees in the south have a better combination or a better blend for dealing with mountain pine beetles than the trees in the north, or that the trees in the south are trying to not be attractive to the mountain pine beetle by simply having fewer monoterpenes, which has the potential to release fewer volatiles for the mountain pine beetle to find them. It's also possible the reason we got higher attack densities in the north is that the mountain pine beetles are actually utilizing the higher terpene content in those trees for their own purposes. While the terpenes are often supposed to be defenses, the mountain pine beetle is capable of taking various terpenes and using them both as a precursor for their aggregation pheromone, which I talked about for their mass attacks. And so they might be utilizing that, which is causing that higher attack density in the north. I've got some acknowledgments. My supervisory committee of Dezine Huber, Alan Carroll, and Staffan Lindgren. I have funding from the Mountain Pine Beetle Initiative and CERT Canada Research Chairs and Canadian Foundation for Innovation. I've had lots of help in the field going to all these field sites, Anna, Marco, Caitlin, and Dan. And then also the Forest Entomology Group up at University of Northern British Columbia, where I am, the Lindgren, Akama, Poirier, and Huber Labs, for letting us bounce ideas and meeting and talking about this stuff. So thank you. Any questions? I don't know if anybody's picked one particular thing that's caused the outbreak, but certainly droughts can affect that. Just stressful conditions on the trees in general weakens their resistance and tends to let them out.
Has there been one recently?
Recently, I'm not sure about recently, but this outbreak has been going on for a while now. So,
Go ahead.
It looks like amount of monoterpene was opposite in the southern site compared to the northern sites where they're low and high suitability climatic zone. And I wondered if you had any hypotheses for why that might be.
Yeah, I'm still working on explaining that, and I'm wondering if some of it may have to do with a ratio in the terpenes, and I'm working on looking at it not just by total that we're finding, but which ones, like the kind of the relationship between them may be important. So that might help explain some of that variation. There also may be a bit of just site-to-site variation, and I may be picking up a bit
of
that.
Do you know what provenance of the trees you had at the different sites, like thinking back to the previous talk?
These trees were just, the provenances are usually from different areas in British Columbia, and so instead of doing provenance trials, we just went in and took the trees that were actually growing there. So I don't have like a genetic history for these trees, it's just that those were the ones, their mature stands that are growing there, and that's, so we're looking more at the geographic, what's actually present for the beetles to attack.
Aaron, my question is related to trees. I first started working on Mount Pioneer in the Princeton area in 1974. And from then on, for the next 5 or 6 years, there was one massive wave of infestation that killed most of the mature trees in the 70s. Then there was another wave that came through there in the 90s and cleaned up almost everything else. So, you know, there are small little populations left that I'm sure you were involved in sampling. So the question is, do you think that and the trees in the north, this is their first experience mm-hmm. with an infestation. Yeah. So do you think that maybe there was some cause that the trees that you were sampling were those that were left after two waves of infestation come through southern British Columbia?
Yeah. It's possible. I don't have, that's fine, that's fine. It's just, you know, I don't have information about which trees survived the first round. My primary requirement was they had to have a large enough DBH that the beetles would find them acceptable, although they're attacking smaller trees than I even sampled for. It's certainly possible that would lead to the idea that the trees that I sampled in the south would be the trees that would be best resistant to mountain pine beetle. But the infestation's pretty bad there, so there must be a new set of trees down there as well, because they're pretty much all getting wiped out again. So I don't think we're just left with the remnants of the previous infestation. There's still some new trees in there coming through.
Aaron, show the results from your northern site and your southern site, but through the central sites,
they tended to be a bit more comparable towards the south, although there was not all the terpenes worked out exactly the same. It's a bit of a gradient, although it's not a perfect gradient on that. But they tended to fall a bit more towards the middle, with a tendency to look more like the southern site than the northern.
Weren't you first going to do some sites in the United States?
Yeah, that would have been interesting to move down into Washington as well, but I wasn't able to work out all the permits for getting live material.
Thank you, Aaron. Today I'm going to share my results of 2 years study, that is on assessment. The study was on assessment of imidacloprid and horticultural oil treatments on predators associated with eastern hemlock. So I would like to start with a brief introduction of hemlock. Hemlock is distributed throughout eastern United States, and Carolina hemlock is limited to Carolina. On these both species, hemlock woolly adelgid is very destructive, and these both trees are susceptible to hemlock woolly adelgid. So hemlock is an important component of eastern United States. Hemlock is an important component of forest ecosystem, because it cools the streams of streams, and it also it is also associated with a lot of wild life habitat. It helps to reduce erosion, and it is also an ornamental plant, and about 120 species are associated with eastern hemlock. So hemlock woolly adelgid attack, it is native to Asia, and it is a aphid-like insect. It penetrates stylets into the tree system, and it sucks the juice. It was earlier introduced into North America in 1924, but later in 1951 it was introduced in Virginia. It feeds, as I earlier said, it feeds on both eastern as well as Carolina hemlock. This figure shows a distribution of hemlock woolly adelgid. In green area, it is a distribution of eastern hemlock, while the dark area is distribution of hemlock woolly adelgid, and the yellow part, yellow dots shows recent infestation of hemlock woolly adelgid. So it seems it is expanding in all its directions. So damage, hemlock woolly adelgid feeds on needles, and it depletes nutrition, which makes the tree very weak. And in after initial infestation, colonies establish very easily. And within 4 to 10 years of infestation, trees are gone, and they are very very infected. And to control these hemlock woolly adelgid, a lot of chemicals are applied, but among these, imidacloprid is widely used, which is a systemic insecticide. Over here, I have a hypothesis for this project, for this research. There is a triangle between chemicals, especially imidacloprid, and herbivorous insects and predators. To kill the hemlock woolly adelgid, we are applying imidacloprid on a hemlock tree. So what happens, it kills also hemlock woolly adelgid and other herbivorous insects, but on the other hand, predators feed on these herbivorous insects, and they are also getting imidacloprid, and they are also killed. So in other words, we can say in this system, predators are on the hemlock, pest is also hemlock. So it is a natural system. But to kill the pest, what we are doing is we are spraying with various chemicals or various horticulture oils. So these have a bad impact or negative impact. So these. So these predators, as well as pest, also living are. If pest is killed by these chemicals, then definitely these predators are also killed. So, and they are either living or they are being killed. So the basic the objectives of this study was to assess the impact of imidacloprid against hemlock, which is used against hemlock woolly adelgid. And the second was to determine the diversity and the seasonal abundance of predators on eastern hemlock. And the third was to assess the influence of vertical stratification on predator density. So to achieve these objectives, we started a study in the Indian boundary in Cherokee National Forest. We took 30 trees, and these trees were in blocks, and there were 3 blocks, and each block there were 10 trees. And within 10 trees, we treated 5 trees in fall 2005 and 5 in April 2006. So horticultural oil treatment and horticultural oil was treated as, and there was only treatment on control trees. The same as imidacloprid treatment, we used imidacloprid in 3 different ways of applications. So these show the top, on the left it shows tree injection, on the lower side it shows soil injection, and in middle it shows a soil drench, and on right it shows foliar spray of horticulture oil. So sampling, we made samples throughout 2006 and 2007. We collected observed the main trunk for at least 15 minutes, and also we took one bead sheet from each cardinal direction, and we also installed a mullet strap. And this data was analyzed in SPSS and also tested with LSD. In vertical stratification, to get vertical stratification, we divided this tree into 3 strata: the top, middle, and the bottom. And we sampled two times in August 2006 and in September 2007. And like other samples, we also took three bead sheet samples per stratum, and also a direct observation for at least 15 minutes per stratum. So for the results, we collected about more than 4,000 predators during this entire sampling season, and these were comprises about 10 arthropod orders. And the spiders were more abundant on all collections. And among more than 60% of our predators were comprised of five spider families. So these are the spider families which we collected. This shows in earlier season in winter the population of predator was low, but it built up gradually, and it went a peak in August, and gradually then after September it gradually decreased. We didn't find any significant difference between fall and spring treatments. And the spider as well as other predator density was same in fall as well as in spring treatments. That was for 2006, but then we again sampled in 2007, and we found same results, except we found that the predator density was going up. So these are pesticide applications, which shows that there was a different significant difference between control and horticulture oil as compared to other treatments of imidacloprid. So this is for 2007. We got same result, but imidacloprid treatments we saw that the overall population is building. So this also shows that because we applied this treatment in 2005 and we sampled 2006 and 2007, but in 2007 we saw that the predator abundance is gradually building up. In vertical stratification, we could not find any difference between top and middle, but there was a significant difference between bottom and other stratum. In conclusion, spiders were abundant on eastern hemlock. Time of application has no impact on predator density, and imidacloprid treatments, regardless of their application, had reduced the predator density. And the predator density was higher on the top and middle strata than lower strata. And with this, I would like to thank Dr. Jerome Grant, Dr. Fassnamdin, Frank Harvesty, and also Cherokee National Forest and Fulbright IIE for granting me. And any question, please? We are working, we are three students, we are working on this project. So Carla took the samples, and she has results. She is backside. Yes.
Why do you think the imidacloprid reduced the population?
Is it
because the amount of prey was reduced?
Yeah, because insects are feeding on the plant tissues, and the plant tissue is already has imidacloprid. And the prey, the insect is getting imidacloprid in the system, and later when predator feed on the pest, then eventually it is also getting, and they are intoxicated, and they are maybe killed or they may leave the area. Next.
We may leave there.
Okay.
Thank you.
This is, as we have seen and heard, the title of our debate topic. However, if we simply emphasize a few words and introduce four points, we find that this statement becomes easier to reject. So our topic is, scientific journals and government agencies should review all papers for biosecurity concerns and refrain from publishing those containing information that may be helpful to bioterrorists? Well, maybe not, and in fact, probably not. There are many reasons why we should not refrain from publishing all papers that scientific journals or government agencies have reviewed and said simply may be helpful to bioterrorists. Here are 4 points that support this. First of all, we would find ourselves violating the most significant step in any scientist's research, publishing our results. Also, we would need to analyze and understand the costs and benefits of dual-use research and know that limiting publication of papers that may be helpful to terrorists could actually put society in greater danger. Third, existing government regulations and corporate research and development contracts already keep sensitive information from being disseminated to the public. And finally, the simple fact of the matter is this: coordinating such a restriction is impossible. First, we'll talk about the scientific process. It is ironic that we are debating this topic at a conference whose theme is communication, which is an integral step in the scientific process. Publishing results as a critical part of the scientific process is not only a time-honored tradition in science, but allows scrutiny by our peers. Communicating results to the scientific community occurs most readily and effectively through publication in journals. It is important that this ability be maintained. In 2001, MIT President Charles Vest wrote, "The advanced education of scientists depends on the critical openness of the scientific process, publication, and participation in scientific institutions in and out of the United States." Next, we'll move on to dual-use research. It is important to realize that in order to decide whether a scientific publication is safe to publish, a systematic cost-benefit analysis is necessary. To do this, we need to understand what dual-use research encompasses. Here's the definition of dual-use research from the NSABB. Potentially dangerous knowledge, products, or technologies, as well as misapplications and perceived threat, are all terms that we cannot now capture with fixed lists or definitions. Yet, according to our debate topic, scientific journals and government agencies should refrain from publishing this indefinable information with no current logical, concrete cost-benefit assessments. It is imperative that science not be impeded by political and administrative ideology. And if scientific work hinges upon this flexible definition of dual use, then it may endanger the quality and progress the science our nation produces. Banning certain scientific research from publication based on ill-conceived, non-systematic analyses may actually create greater dangers to our society. Trust and confidence are key elements of international cooperation in arms control and security. So only complete transparency will allow nations to determine the intentions of other, discourage unfounded suspicions, and build confidence in multilateral compliance. The Corson Report, which was a 1982 report in the National Academies, concluded that greater security would be achieved by the open pursuit of scientific knowledge than by attempts to curtail the free exchange of scientific information. This is exactly our point. Moving on to existing regulations. Protocols are already in place to keep scientific information from being widely disseminated. The U.S. government has the Classified Information Act to restrict publishing selected government research, and corporations have confidentiality agreements to keep scientists from divulging information. Numerous projects have been successfully executed behind closed doors, suggesting that existing protocols are indeed sufficient to maintain security on issues of sensitivity without further suppressing the ability of scientists to publish their results. Finally, our last and most logical point, the logistics and illogic of limiting publication. Although increased security is noble and debates on its virtues and flaws rage on, the simple fact is this: the logistics of coordinating such a screening of publication are impossible. First, any ban would have to be international, as a national ban would do nothing except encourage scientists to publish elsewhere. Getting worldwide agreement on anything, much less on an issue of security, would be nearly impossible. Further, imposing bans on journal publication does nothing to stop this research from being disseminated via the internet, personal letters, or other means of communication. Dual-use research will not cease if it is not published. We can compound the problem by limiting science and in the end cause more societal harm than the harm we are trying to prevent. Limiting science didn't work in Galileo's day and is imprudent, let alone impossible, today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question was, do we think all science is always beneficial? And no, we don't think all science is always beneficial, but we think the publication of all science that's conducted is always beneficial.
So can you explain again, how can limiting certain aspects of publication put us in greater danger? Can you explain that?
By limiting certain aspects of publication, he wants to know how that can pose a greater danger. When work is done, the knowledge is there. And if the knowledge is not made available to people who can counter potentially dangerous knowledge, then we've made it an insecure point for our society. Did I clarify that well? Okay.
One more question.
Yes.
You mentioned in your statement that without cost-benefit analysis, journals should not do that, or government agencies should not